From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. British journalist Christopher Hitchens writes about politics for American magazines. He says the things that made him decide to leave his country are the things Americans are most fascinated with about England. Conservative, stuffy things. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Hitchens about the ironies and the relationship between America and England. Also today, musician Jerry Harrison talks about playing with the Modern Lovers, Talking Heads, and his own band. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews two new albums by veteran performers, Fleetwood Mac and Peter Wolf, formerly of the Jay Giles Band. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new Arnold Schwarzenegger film, Total Recall. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Two of America's best-known leftist journalists have English accents. One of them is my guest, Christopher Hitchens. He's a columnist for The Nation and Washington editor for Harper's. His new book, Blood, Class, and Nostalgia, examines ironies in the relationship between England and America, culturally and politically. Hitchens told me what got him started on the subject.
Well, though I'd been in the United States for about 10 years, I'd only just arrived about 10 years ago when began to notice, as you have to, the sort of amazing deference that was paid to Englishness in America, the way that the British seemed to exist in the American imagination. And this was in, you know, small things like being told by AT&T operators that they liked my accent, to the amazing cult of the royal family in the glossy magazines, the British royal family, to things like Masterpiece Theatre, where, you know, everywhere else in the world, everyone wants to watch American TV. And in America, the educated classes, at least, like to watch what they thought of as quality British programming. And I thought there was a clue in that. All that was all to do with things about class and society and empire and so forth. These seem to be, in fact, to be the recurring themes. So that's why my book is called Blood, Class, and Nostalgia.
I'm interested in what else people responded to and still respond to in you as an Englishman.
Well, I think often they're kind enough not to say. I actually remember when I very first came to the United States, I was getting on a bus at JFK and a guy overheard me asking directions and came up and said, "We all like Masterpiece Theatre." And I remember thinking, I don't know what he means by that. He obviously thought that this was a good way of recognizing my Englishness. I now do know exactly what he meant. I noticed also that one would get asked questions on aeroplanes by people. After shouting for a drink, they'd recognize I was British and would say, "Well, what about Princess Diana?" And so it generally tended to be that they liked the things about England that I had come to America to get away from.
Such as?
Such as monarchy, such as the vestiges of the empire, such as the way that you can tell anyone's social background by the way they speak as soon as they open their mouth. We call it being branded on the tongue in England. And then, you know, you didn't have to hang around very long in Washington to notice that there was a certain kind of iconography of people like Winston Churchill, sometimes Gladstone and Disraeli, but most often Churchill, when heroic speech was required by a president, usually calling on some policy of folly to be followed by the Congress or the press, they would always invoke analogies based on Churchill, Munich, Dunkirk, and so forth. I thought they've got, you know, a glorious history of their own in this country, a particularly good one, beginning, in fact, with the expulsion of the British monarchy from the national territory. Why do they never call on that? Then one day I was watching Oliver North being questioned by the House Foreign Affairs Committee, and a row broke out between two American legislators, both from California. This is in my book. One quoting Kipling and the other quoting Shakespeare, both about destiny and history and the military and so forth. And I thought, this is really weird. There is a book in here somewhere about the ghost of England that exists in the American body. And that's really what I've tried chapter by chapter to do an anatomy of.
So when Americans respond to Masterpiece Theater or admire you for your accent, what do you think they're secretly responding to?
Well, I think, see, the fact is that there are various words in America that can't be used with ease, that can be used in England with ease. We say the word empire unaffectedly. We never said we didn't have one. The United States does have an empire and says it doesn't. The same with class. Officially, there is no class system in the United States. In fact, the fact that there is not admitted to be one is one of the reasons it's allowed, I think, to go on. Now, in this country, people say you've got class to mean all kinds of things. You've got style, you've got moxie, you've got this, all got that. But it's an interesting choice of term, don't you think, that they would say class was the thing you wanted. And they're borrowing at second hand, therefore, something that comes to them from an ancestral and traditional. I think probably the key word here is tradition. It's the yearning for a tradition in literature, in history, to some extent in politics, and borrowing it without quite realizing what they're getting. They're getting a rather kitsch version of Englishness and having it recycled through the American system.
Do you think it's very unusual for a country that broke away from a country through a revolution to then want to emulate the country in so much of its culture?
It's, I think, entirely unprecedented, except perhaps in some bits of French-speaking Africa, where, you know, the school lessons used to begin with young African children chanting that their Gallic ancestors had blonde hair and blue eyes, because they'd been taught that by the French, and so forth, and the impressions that left. With this difference that, of course, now Britain is, in effect, a colony of the United States. I mean, certainly there's no precedent in history for the former colonial dependency becoming the actual imperial power. The only near analogy you can come to is one that the British establishment really love, and I have a chapter about this, that they think that Britain's new role in the world is to be Greece to the American Rome. That's to say, the older, exhausted, played out, but still in some way sophisticated culture lends a bit of tone and depth and style to the new, brash, vulgar, modern, enormous empire. And that was a self-consciously articulated position of a lot of British politicians starting in the Second World War, when they realized, look, the game's up. You know, we've managed to get America into Europe on our side now twice. They've saved the British bacon, but the price of this is going to be we will not be equals with them. We'll be the junior partner from now on.
Well, what way do you think England has become the junior partner or a colony of the United States?
Well, I give three examples in the book. One is, for instance, British nuclear technology was the first in the world to be developed for weaponry, and it was an enormous asset to the British in bargaining for American support in the Second World War. But within 4 or 5 years, the United States had got the secret for itself, had vastly outstripped the British, who then found, you know, they were having to petition with the Americans for simple sharing of information on nuclear questions. So that was a very, very quick example of, you know, the borrowing from the British of a scheme, a grand idea, converting it in effect for use against them. In a different way, you could say that the whole mythology of the spy world, which is very important in American fiction, in American movies, in American culture, the CIA, the OSS, and the rest of it, was completely invented on the British model with British advice and British help, again, as part of our grand project always, to involve America in war on our side. But after a bit, you know, the CIA and the rest of it became so much more important and commanding that Britain became a junior partner in that respect too, though still thinking it did things slightly better and with a bit more panache and skill and sophistication, nonetheless conceding the main point of power. I said I'd give three examples. I've now forgotten what the third one is. Those are the sorts of things I write about it, at any rate.
Let me reintroduce you. My guest is Christopher Hitchens, and he's a columnist for The Nation and Washington editor for Harper's. His new book is called Blood, Class, and Nostalgia, Anglo-American Ironies. You're saying that American Anglophiles are really expressing a very conservative impulse. On the other hand, I think you've left out a really important part of the English influence on America, and that's the Beatles, the whole British invasion of the 1960s. And I think for anybody who was growing up then, I mean, if you were copying a British accent, it wasn't because you wanted to be a duke or the prince or the queen. It's because you wanted to be John Lennon. Do you know what I mean? And
yes, I do know what you mean, certainly. And I've wrestled with it a bit in the book. Things, people were not copying Liverpool accents any more than they were copying, you know, South London or suburban accents with the admiration from Mick Jagger. It's true there was a time when Britain represented itself as being finally classless in the early 60s, and that made it probably easier for its popular culture to be exported. But that's now no longer the case. I mean, by the time I got here, certainly, the thing that all Americans were absorbing most eagerly from Britain was Brideshead Revisited.
Well, since the Beatles aren't mentioned in your index, I was wondering if you're kind of overlooking of the British invasion.
I think you'll find Liverpool. I think you'll find Liverpool. Is it? You'll look under L.
Okay. But I was wondering if this was perhaps a reflection of your class?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, yes, of course it is. Everything about me is, as is true of anyone born in my country. However long we stay away, you know, you don't escape that kind of upbringing. But I do notice in the book, I do mention the Beatles under Liverpool. I do also mention that skinhead and punk are two things that have been emulated from Britain while I've been in the United States. Now, both of those were authentic expressions of a British proletarian, in one case, semi-fascism, I'm speaking of the skinheads, and in the other case, of a sort of slightly neurotic despair about unemployment and the blank generation, as they call themselves. But well, when they were taken up here, they were as points of style. You know, they were things to emulate. They were fashion statements. In Britain, they actually were genuine features of the social scene and comments on the social fabric. So that, in other words, I mean, you may think I'm trying to have it both ways, but it seems that as long as it was British, it was in some way automatically intelligible, even if it didn't fit the usual diagram of the country house, the red uniform, the Khyber Pass, the, you know, the rest of it, the upstairs-downstairs fantasy.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Christopher Hitchens. His new book is called Blood, Class, and Nostalgia, Anglo-American Ironies. He's also a columnist for The Nation and Washington editor for Harper's Magazine. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Okay, we left off wondering where the Beatles and punk music fit into your view of how English culture has influenced American culture. And I asked you if you thought this was related to your class or not. So what is your class? Were you at what strata were you born?
Well, a great deal of trouble is spent on giving a confusing answer or being able to give a confusing answer to that question. As it happens, I mean, I'm a Navy brat. My father came from a rather poor area of Portsmouth, which is a Navy town where most of my male ancestors come from. And due to the exigencies of war and so forth, by the time I was born, he was an officer. In other words, he'd moved up a class through the sort of turmoil of the mid-20th century. And what you do in England if you move up a class is you send the proof of it, the certificate of it, is you send your firstborn son, that's me in this case, to private school. I was the first Hitchens to be privately educated. We call them public schools just to keep you guessing.
Right.
Also the first one to go to university, in my case, Oxford. But I'm the first one in my family to, if you like, sound like this. And you were made to feel it very much, that you were, in that sense, upwardly mobile. I'm always a bit embarrassed to talk about my biography in this way. I don't know quite how it fits me to talk on this subject. An interesting fact about it, though, is that at the level of society in which I was brought up, there was very, very, very strong lower middle class anti-Americanism of a conservative kind, a sort that's dying out now. People thinking basically that the United States had cheated Britain out of the empire, had let Britain bleed during the war, and had picked up, you know, the colonies as part of the price of stepping in belatedly. This was part of the mythology of a resentful, declining country. And I think that probably had quite an influence on me when I came to write on these subjects later.
You are really one of the more visible leftist journalists in the United States, with regular appearances both in The Nation and Harper's Magazine, as well as writing books and writing for other places. I'm wondering if you think that your British accent helped you in your career in America. You know, even though you're British and are writing for American papers, you've done very well. Do you think that the British accent helps make your leftist views more palatable to those Americans who don't think of themselves as leftists?
Well, I've certainly tried not to be a professional Englishman, as some journalists who've come here, I won't mention any names, but I'm sure they're well known to the sort of people who listen to National Public Radio. You know who they are.
And I won't ask you what sort you mean by that catty comment.
I don't want to be a professional Brit, and when I write, I don't write in an English accent.
Uh-huh.
So people, though, I think some people claim to be able to guess. Occasionally it comes up. No, I mean, it hasn't. Nor has it been what I thought it might be, which is a disadvantage. That's to say, I've been very impressed that, you know, I've often been on radio shows and debated with prominent conservatives and told them where I think they're wrong and why their President Reagan is no good and so forth, and now they're President Bush. And only on, I think, one occasion did anyone ever say anything like, well, if that's how you feel, why don't you go home, sort right. of attitude. Very, very, very rare. Also reflected in the mailbag I get and the phone calls. It's an incredibly generous and courteous attitude of the sort that we're supposed to. I mean, we, the British, are well known actually to be the rudest people in the world. We're supposed to exemplify the kind of politeness you actually only find in the United States. So, no, I think not. The advantage it's given me, I think, and the advantage given in writing this book, is that I was brought up in a country that was beginning to get used to the idea of no longer being a superpower, but was doing so reluctantly and very painfully. By superpower, I really mean, obviously, not any longer being an empire. And that has been a help to me in analysing America, I think, because you hear occasional politicians saying, well, if we don't stop them in fill-in wherever the blank may be, Grenada, Beirut, Saigon, you know, Salvador, they'll be at the borders in no time and so forth, and civilization will come to an end. And I thought, yeah, I've heard all that before. I heard that when I was eight from, you know, ridiculous Tories saying we should be governing Egypt. So it made it easier to be unimpressed.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it's made me sad, because there are lots of things about Britain that I do admire, I want to say, that never do get praised here, or not praised enough, and don't get borrowed. We have, for example, still, despite Thatcher, a very good national health provision. We also have quite a good parliamentary system where, you know, the Prime Minister just has to come twice every week and really get it from the legislators without notes and without advisers and without handlers. And face it, it would be wonderful if the United States would borrow things like that. Instead, what you tend to borrow is monarchic ideas for your presidency and sort of social Darwinist ideas from Thatcher. And this is a pity, it seems to me, because both countries have a great deal to teach one another. In Britain, I always argue, we should have an American Constitution. We should have your Bill of Rights instead of our unwritten conservative compromise, which we don't even dare call a Constitution. So this is why I'm trying to tease out in this sort of mid-Atlantic way in the book why it is that all the borrowings tend to be reinforcements of conservatism. I think that's an intriguing subject to pursue.
I think the American and British identity is being changed by new waves of immigrants.
Mm.
And I was wondering if you could compare how you think both countries are reacting to the new immigrants that are living in their countries.
Yeah, this is real history. I mean, and again, I have a chapter on this. It was very noticeable when the campaign against immigration first began in the United States in the 1890s. It was very, very specifically stated that the intention of opposing immigration in the United States was to preserve the Anglo-Saxon and Protestant character of the establishment. It was very specifically anti-Catholic, anti-Jewish, and so forth. And people then didn't pretend they were talking about anything else. And that's where we get the idea of the WASP from. In Britain, of course, that's always said very fairly explicitly, too. It's a matter of preserving the character of the country against these hideous outsiders. The difference is Britain wasn't built by immigrants in quite the same way as your country has been, so that it's always harder in America to be anti-immigrant per se, unless you are an explicit racist, which of course some people are. And of course the United States is very big and has lots of room, and Britain is rather small. In both cases, though, the axiomatic assumption that the country is white and in some sense Christian, and by Christian they tend to mean Protestant, is being challenged, yes, demographically.
Christopher Hitchens is my guest, and he's a columnist for The Nation and Washington editor for Harper's Magazine. His new book is called Blood, Class, and Nostalgia, Anglo-American Ironies. I'm going to change the subject for a moment. I'm wondering how you think the American left has dealt with the fall of communism in Eastern Europe, and if you think that journalists or writers or just people active in the American left have felt any impulse to defend communism as it's fallen.
I've found that the admission by the Soviets and their former allies that their system was almost a perfect failure, that it really didn't work in any way at all, didn't even work as a military and police system, let alone as an economy or a society, actually come to most people as an enormous relief. I mean, I can think of one or two people who have a faint nostalgia for the, as it were, the old motherland of the October Revolution. But generally speaking, no, people are very, very glad at the emancipation that's come and hope that it translates into an emancipation of American politics from this stupid Manichean search for communist malevolence behind any movement for reform or amelioration. And that would certainly be my position.
Have you been to Eastern Europe recently?
Yes, I was in Romania and Hungary over Christmas. I was in Romania on the first day of the post-Ceausescu epoch, in fact, and I'd come there from Budapest. And not long before that, had been in Czechoslovakia, where actually I was briefly arrested and deported for attending a Charter 77 meeting, where the intention had been to bring together all the Eastern European dissident movements and all the Western European and American disarmament movements and discuss the relationship between human rights and détente and denuclearization, which, of course, has always been the crucial relationship.
How were you asked to leave Czechoslovakia?
Well, I wasn't asked, I was told.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they locked us up for a bit and then threw us out and told us not to come back. I'm very proud, in fact, of the deportation stamp in my passport. I'm hoping to use it to cash in when I go back there. Certainly people I used to know then whose names couldn't be mentioned in the press are now things like ministers and professors and so forth. And it is one of the great pleasures in life to go back to a country you knew when it was once a dictatorship, when it's been emancipated. There's no feeling quite like it. It makes participation in politics worthwhile.
Is this the first time you've experienced that?
No, it's not. In Spain and in Portugal and in Greece, which were the three NATO free world dictatorships in Europe supported by the United States, I've had that experience in all three. I hope to have it in Turkey before long, though that seems to be a very stubborn case. I hope to have it in Chile. I have had it in Zimbabwe, formerly Southern Rhodesia. And hope to have it in South Africa. Let's see, where else have I had it? Prompt me. There is another one. It'll come back to me. Oh, Argentina. Anyway, yeah, and I think also when I go back to South Korea, with any luck, I might be able to say that it certainly can't be any worse than it was when I went with Kim Dae-jung, the opposition leader, the day after Elliot Abrams, human rights spokesman for the Reagan administration, had said that if anyone killed him, it would obviously be the communists, and thus had licensed in advance any further attempts on his life by the regime, which had in fact been trying to kill him.
If I'm not mistaken, you have a brother who's also a journalist, but is much more conservative?
Yes, how do you know that? Yes, I do. Yeah, I've got a brother who's a very distinguished Fleet Street journalist. He's defense and diplomatic correspondent for a paper called the Daily Express. He's actually moving, I believe he's moving to Moscow soon.
Which one of you is the one that doesn't fit in with the rest of the family?
I suppose that would have to be me. But actually, in making our living this way at all, neither of us do, in that, you know, all the other Hitchinses back into history have, in a sense, been naval or military, so we're just scribblers. He, for some reason, really admires our Prime Minister and went, in fact, as far as admiring your last president. So we had lots to talk about when we used to meet, which was usually only at summits.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Anytime.
Christopher Hitchens' new book is Blood, Class, and Nostalgia, Anglo-American Ironies. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, comic George Carlin. I hope you can join us.
Now we come to the practical portion of our show. This is the practical stuff. This is where I actually give advice. Little tips and hints and suggestions on things that'll help the quality of life. Little things you can put to work almost immediately. In fact, some of you may be aware of my more famous tips from the past. How to get rid of counterfeit money? Put it in the collection plate at church. See how often the simple solution will elude us. Here's one, how to get out of jury duty. Lots of people try that, don't they? And they do. A lot of them get out of jury duty by lying. You don't have to lie. Tell the judge the truth. Tell him you'll make a terrific juror because you can spot guilty people just like that. Hell yeah. Well, today's suggestions are a little different. These are just sort of hints on things you can do to keep other people alert during the day when you're out and about your business. Little ways to keep people on their toes, because people need that. And I'm not talking about your friends so much. It's just the general public. People need a little sort of a mental goose during the day to kind of bring them back to reality, you know?
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When musician Jerry Harrison dropped out of architecture school to join the Talking Heads, architecture's loss was rock's gain. Harrison has also been a member of another influential group, the Modern Lovers. And he has a new album out by his own group, the Casual Gods. Coming up, a talk with Jerry Harrison. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums by Fleetwood Mac and Peter Wolfe. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Total Recall, the summer's first big action film. It stars Arnold Schwarzenegger and was directed by Paul Verhoeven of RoboCop fame. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
We were barely lovers. We had hardly kissed at all. Something there between us. Something so unusual.
This is Fresh Air. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of two new albums by performers who've been on the music scene for a couple of decades. Ken says Peter Wolfe is still a contender in the rock arena, but Fleetwood Mac sound is getting old.
The sky is the limit now. We can hit it on the lid. And when we do, I think about you. How can we fail? The sky is the limit.
I had planned to ignore the recent spate of new recordings by veteran performers. There's enough fresh music by up-and-coming rockers around that it seemed pointless to spend a review rehashing the career of someone like Peter Wolfe, who used to lead the Jay Giles Band, or Fleetwood Mac with its two new members and its watered-down identity. But then I realized that their extremes are interesting. The Peter Wolfe record is so unexpectedly good. The Fleetwood Mac is so dismayingly bad.
When I close.
Ever since Lindsey Buckingham left Fleetwood Mac a few years ago, the band has been an aimless, drifting outfit. The two new guys, Billy Burnett and Rick Vito, are both excellent musicians, but they can't keep this album, Behind the Mask, from sounding like anything more than a reiteration of the band's previous themes and melodies. Earnest yet tired, well-crafted yet deadening, this is the sound of musicians who need a creative shot in the arm. Fleetwood Mac sounds enervated, Peter Wolfe sounds rejuvenated. His new collection, called Up to No Good, is a revelation, lively and witty in its approach to middle-aged rock and roll.
I know I got a nasty reputation. I know I've been bad, but I always had style. So I understand your constant hesitation.
Yeah.
As the yammering lead voice in the Jay Giles Band, Peter Wolf was a charming latter-day hipster, haggard, pencil-thin, and vaguely menacing-looking, yet articulate and funny about his devotion to rock, soul, and rhythm and blues. The two solo albums he made after leaving Jay Giles were, respectively, Uneven and Disastrous, but Up to No Good can stand comparison to the best of the Jay Giles Band, and indeed to music by any whippersnapper around today. Wolf sounds relaxed and playful. Maybe he's given up on the idea of reclaiming his stardom and just decided to make a record to please himself. More than anything else he's done, Up to No Good reveals the full range of Wolf's musical taste.
Love light's shining, and the music's turned way down low. If you want her, really need her, oh, you better let her know. Don't make her a stranger in your arms. Don't let her good love die.
The kicker to all of this is that Peter Wolf's album is already a flop, drifting off the charts only a few weeks after its release. And Fleetwood Mac's Behind the Mask is a top 20 hit on the rise. It's a cruel world out there.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh air. The band Talking Heads hasn't gone on tour since 1984, so their guitarist and keyboard player, Jerry Harrison, formed his own band, The Casual Gods. They have a new record called Walk on Water. In the early 70s, Harrison played keyboards in a band that's now seen as a forerunner of punk, the Modern Lovers. In 1977, he became the fourth Talking Head. This summer, while the Talking Heads' frontman, David Byrne, continues recording his current obsession, Brazilian music, the other three heads, Harrison, Chris Franz, and Tina Weymouth, will go on tour together. Jerry Harrison spoke with Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet about his new record, Walk on Water. One of the songs takes its lyric from a book about the painter Jackson Pollock. The song is Cowboys Got to Go.
Ground underneath heel of misfortune, jammed on the cleat
hustled you. I wanted simply to hold you. Now the Indian can stay, but the cowboy gotta go. All right.
When you first went to make your own records, did you find that you were a singer, or was that something you had to work on? Did you physically have to work on your voice and also work on developing your style?
Yes. I had sung in bands, but I had not been the lead singer in bands. I'd sung songs here and there, but it was not something I'd done so consistently that I had a clear idea of what I could do with my voice. And so it became a process of discovery. And for instance, on this record, that's one of the reasons I liked writing in different styles, because it opened up all sorts of avenues of expression for me to experiment with. Mm-hmm. I think the tour we did with Casual Gods really was a very exciting thing for me, because there's one thing about singing on records and even singing at home, and there's another thing about going out and every night singing for an hour in front of people. And you get this feedback from people, and you learn things that you can do and things that maybe you better not do.
Back in the early 70s, you were studying at Harvard when you first hooked up with the Modern Lovers. Had you always seen yourself as a musician? Did your whole life think, well, I'm going to be in a band, or did you think that you would probably become a more practical architect or something?
No, I thought when I went to Harvard, I sold all of the instruments that I'd had. I was in high school bands. I thought, now my life is going to be serious. And then the guy who lived downstairs from me, who was Ernie Brooks, started forming a band, and I'd kind of go to their rehearsals and, like, say, making suggestions and saying, finally I was like, forget it. Went out and bought a whole bunch of new equipment and started again. But even then, it was still seemed like a sideline until I got involved with the Modern Lovers. And when I got involved with the Modern Lovers, I realized that we were making as important music as anybody in the world. And at that point, I realized I would be a professional musician. And it was very good for me, because it became a professional musician and thinking about music in a way about ideas rather than like whether you could play more fluidly or faster or anything like that. And I think that if there was anything that set the new wave or punk rock off from what was going on in those days, that is that attitude, is that idea comes first and ability second.
Share the modern world with me. Cause I'm in love with the USA now. I'm in love with the modern world now. Put down the cigarette and drop out of BU. All right.
This Modern Lovers group ended up, well, it's now seen as being really seminal to punk rock, which didn't get started years later. But at the time you were doing it, did it seem like you were part of something that was really significant?
We seemed like we were out on the edge to me. I mean, I would put on these concerts and I'd hire the hall and get a permit from the police department, and then some policeman would come and be there for, I don't know, as a guard, I guess, and make posters and do all of this stuff, and then we'd play, and then at the end, all the money would go to all of those elements, and we'd walk home with $5 or something like that, and it was very rough. It seems very romantic now, but at the time, it took a lot of fortitude, you might say.
So you had a fairly small cult following?
Yes. And as we were breaking up is when it really started to get bigger, naturally.
Why did it break up?
Well, Jonathan had moved away from what I would say is like what his love of the Velvet Underground into a love of Van Morrison. And he changed his whole style of songwriting and changed his way of playing guitar.
Was Jonathan starting to do his, like, the wheels on the bus period?
Yes, he was in his... I remember him writing, "Hey There, Little Insect," in the backseat of my car and refusing to go look at the Grand Canyon because he was busy. And we drove all the way here. You're not going to see it. Okay. But on the other hand, he wrote a song. But, I mean, I also... those songs that he that then developed, to me, he was cutting off a portion of our audience that I found a very important part to reach. When The Modern Lovers was going in Boston, and we sounded like the first Modern Lovers record sounds, we would play a place like Arlington High School, which was a fairly kind of blackboard jungle style high school. And we would play songs like She Cracked, and the audience would go crazy thinking that this... And so it was kind of the harshness and the hardness of the sound appealed to their ears. And yet we also had these very, very sensitive lyrics like, when you get out of the hospital, will you let me back into your life? And I thought, this is so great. I thought that Jonathan's change in songwriting put him into... He lost all of those people. It was only the people that already were sensitive that were interested in what he was doing. And I wasn't so interested in cutting ourselves off from that. And on top of that, he left less and less room for the other musicians. So it became so unchallenging, it just had to end. Mm.
So then it was a few years later you ended up joining the Talking Heads. How did you hook up with them?
Actually, they called me up. I was living in Boston, broke, and they were looking for a keyboard player, and all these people brought my name up to them. And the Modern Lovers record had recently come out in Berserkly, so it was quite known in those circles. So they called me up and said, would I mind coming down and try playing together? I said, I'd love to. And the only way I could get to New York was I did a moving job. I moved someone else's furniture to New York. It was the only way I could afford to even get there. And so we loaded up the truck, and there wasn't room for my keyboard. It was so crowded, so I just took a guitar. So I arrive at their loft, and they say, I thought you were a keyboard player. Well, I am, but I just couldn't bring it. So I brought my guitar. So we went out and had Chinese food, and then we went back and started rehearsing around 1 o'clock in the morning. And I think from the moment we started, it just was great. And I think all of us thought, this is going to work.
And when you joined, was the band still playing at CBGB's
mm-hmm.
regularly?
Yes.
And was that was sort of the beginning of the punk movement? And mm-hmm. when we look back on it now, it seemed
yes.
like it was probably really exciting. Did it seem that way then?
Absolutely. Because it was the first time there had been an underground since the 60s. And I think the underground was largely created by the record companies ignoring it. And so these bands had a couple of years to develop without the pressures of being signed to record companies and doing world tours or even tours of the United States. And so everyone had kind of an us against them attitude, but us was all the bands.
At a certain point, I guess around the time when Talking Heads recorded Remain in Light, they really started turning towards African music mm-hmm. a lot more. And then it was a tour right after that when you expanded the band.
That's
for the
right.
tour, right? And you played a large part in pulling that band together,
That's right.
didn't you? Now, was that because you were more interested in the funkier music or more knowledgeable about it?
I think the reason that I hired the band is I just took the job on. But also, I had been living in New York the most. So when David and I sat down while we were finishing mixing Remain in Light, we said, if we're going to play this live, we've played all these different parts on these records. We can't do it all ourselves. So we said, okay, well, we're going to need two keyboard players. We need another guitar. We're going to need a percussion player. Even we're going to need another bass player, maybe. So I went out one afternoon, and I just called up all the best people I knew, and they all said yes. And I came back like an hour later and said, well, here's our new band. We have Adrian Ballou playing guitar and Bernie Worrell, and I mean, and Brian and David Gwynne. How did you do that? It was like so astonishing, and that was the beginning of it. I also think it was the beginning of people seeing David apart from the rest of the band, because I think that when we were a four-piece, the way the lighting was is usually you could always see everyone in the band. And I always thought of us as a diamond that kind of rotated and you always saw new facets too. Once we had eight people on stage, your eye just can't take that all in. And I think that then the lights began to direct your attention more, and naturally they direct them towards the singers.
Do you have any idea what's going to happen with the Talking Heads in the future?
No. I don't have any idea.
Okay.
It's really up to David. I mean, I'm ready. I would like to make a record and do a tour, so I kind of feel like we owe it to our audience, but we'll see.
Jerry Harrison spoke with Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet. His new Casual Gods record is titled Walk on Water. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what do you have on the summit?
Well, news today about the meetings between President Bush and Mikhail Gorbachev, the first of this summit, and also some of the scene around Washington, D.C., as the two leaders met, and a report from Ann Cooper on the great change in the Soviet Union since Mikhail Gorbachev came to power, and that is the absence of fear among Soviet citizens, the absence of a fear of retaliation if they speak their minds. Also, a remembrance of the British evacuation from Dunkirk. It was just about 50 years ago that the British Expeditionary Force fled across the English Channel back home in small boats.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The sequel to RoboCop is scheduled for release this summer, but the first movie's director, Paul Verhoeven, didn't have a hand in the second. If you want to see Verhoeven work as futuristic magic, the movie to see is Total Recall. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
No, Total Recall is not the true story of the Ford Pinto. It's this summer's big science fiction blockbuster with Arnold Schwarzenegger. And in this movie, Arnold's not who he thinks he is. He thinks he's a jackhammer operator, although his fancy lifestyle would indicate that in the far-flung future where this movie is set, the Jackhammer Operators Union has made some startling inroads. But Arnold is troubled. He keeps having strange dreams about life in the Earth's colonies on Mars. And then there's this yearning he has. He keeps whining about how he wants to be somebody. Well, it turns out he is. Although he can't remember it, for most of his life he was a kind of secret agent on Mars, working for the evil head of the colony there, played by Ronnie Cox. Now he knows too much about some dark secret up there, and Cox and his henchmen have erased his brain. For his real memories, they've substituted an array of fictional memories. Memories of a happy marriage that never existed, of a life on Earth that's completely made up. When Arnold stumbles on the truth, and makes his way to Mars to regain his identity, he comes across his old girlfriend, Melina, who's part of a guerrilla underground working to free Mars from Cox and his armies. Melina, played by Rachel Takotin, certainly remembers Arnold.
You son of a bitch. You're alive. I thought that Cohagen tortured you to death.
Well, I guess he didn't.
How's it, thank God you're alive?
Melina. Melina, I've got to tell you something.
What?
I don't remember you. I don't remember us. I don't even remember me.
Now, here's a situation full of existential poignancy. It's the kind of situation, in fact, that the director, Paul Verhoeven, has exploited so brilliantly in the past, especially in RoboCop, which was also about the way memory and identity are forever entwined. Total Recall totally recalls RoboCop in other ways, too. It has the same vision of a video-crazed future, a high-tech tomorrow with a jolly pop twist. Here, the blandness of advertising has become the temper of the times, and virtually every innovation is a commercial one. But like so many technological revolutions, the one Verhoeven has imagined is built on greed and ruthlessness, and his movies have a sardonic heart. The violence in them is brutal and disturbingly funny. Verhoeven's the kind of guy who tells us that a bug has been implanted in his hero, a bug that can only be removed quite painfully and graphically through the nose. Verhoeven's earthly vision, his crackerjack special effects, and his lickety-split pacing are almost exciting enough to sustain the movie, but not quite. When the scene shifts to Mars, Total Recall goes limp. Mars itself seems dull and underimagined. And Verhoeven, as if in desperation, tries to revive us with Fellini touches, dwarfs and prostitutes, and for that matter, dwarf prostitutes. Then there's the Arnold problem. This movie doesn't call for a lot of acting, but what little it requires, Schwarzenegger simply can't muster. The beauty of the film's conception is in the way it toys with the psychology of memory. People keep telling our hero that what's happening isn't real. He's being fooled again. This is an implant, not the truth. And this stuff should be shattering. or touching, or at least resonant or intriguing. With Arnold on the screen, it all seems to be happening to a slab of amiable meat.
Stephen Schiff is critic-at-large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Thad Kirk, Ron Barron, Dan Lachlan, and Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, comic George Carlin talks with us without using even one of those seven dirty words. Also, we meet up-and-coming political comic Jimmy Tingle. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.